The Miracles of Jesus by Robert C. Newman, a series of four talks covering five of Jesus' miracles, namely the wedding at Cana in John 2, 1 through 11, the stilling of the storm in Mark 4, 35 to 41, the Gerasene demoniac in Mark 5, 1 through 20, and the intertwined miracles of the healing of the woman with the hemorrhage and the raising of Jairus' daughter in the latter part of Mark 5. What about miracles? Miracles are rejected by theological liberalism and by secularism. This, of course, explains their attitude towards the Gospels and Jesus. Admittedly, if miracles do not happen, cannot happen, then the Gospels cannot really be reliable. So, liberals and secularists feel free to make whatever changes they prefer in the Gospels, some picking one emphasis and some picking another, and so we get rather different kinds of Jesuses. But a Christianity without miracles is not really Christianity. At least it's not any sort of biblical and orthodox Christianity. This was pointed out over 80 years ago by G. Gresham Machen in his book Christianity and Liberalism, where he made the point that theological liberalism was really a different religion. But if miracles are not rejected a priori, then the Gospels in fact look very good historically. This is worked out in some detail by Craig Blomberg in his book The Historical Reliability of the Gospels, still in print, I believe, from InterVarsity. What is the purpose of miracles? The report of a miracle typically serves to create skepticism for many moderns today, but the actual occurrence of a miracle can have a very powerful, even worldview-changing effect on those who witness it. Miracles were used in the Old Testament to attest a messenger from God. We see remarks in this direction in Deuteronomy chapter 13 and Deuteronomy chapter 18. Miracles also tell us something about God and the one who is behind the miracle as well, that he is not just the deistic God who winds up the universe and lets it go, but he's a God who intervenes in the universe in various ways, that perhaps the universe is more like a guitar designed for input than it is like a watch, which it is rather gauche to be opening the back and fiddling around with all the time. What's the purpose of the gospel miracles? Well, they attest to Jesus as coming from God. They support Jesus' claims. They tell us something about who God is and what he is doing. In this series, four talks originally given as sermons, we want to look at five of Jesus' miracles: the wedding at Cana in John 2, the stilling of the storm in the end of Mark 4, the Gerasene demoniac at the beginning of Mark 5, and then the woman with the hemorrhage and Jairus' daughter in Mark 5, 21-43. These will tell us a great deal about Jesus and his mission. So, let's begin with the wedding at Cana, John 2, 1-11. One of the distinctive emphases in the Gospel of John is that of miracles as signs. This is one of the four common words for miracles in the New Testament. One of them emphasizes the power of miracles, dunamis. Two of them emphasize the wonder or marvel of miracles, teres, thauma. And this fourth one, semeion, emphasizes that the miracles are significant. Signs are actions or events which signify something. They need not be miracles, but as John uses them, they basically tend to be. John selects seven or eight miracles for his detailed narrative, the Gospel of John, with the purpose that these would signify who Jesus is, indicate by signs who Jesus is. Well, let's look at the wedding at Cana, the English text here, NIV, in John 2, 1-11. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby, stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. Two terms appear here in the last verse of the passage. And we're told this is Jesus' first sign, presumably meaning the first sign, first miracle of his earthly, or what we might call incarnate, ministry. Bible indicates that Jesus has existed from all times as a second person of the Trinity, presumably had done things before that. This, by the way, undercuts the claims of the apocryphal Gospels that Jesus did earlier miracles, making clay pigeons when he was a little child, and well, a boy anyway, and clapping his hands and they flew off, or cursing a boy and the boy fell dead and such. Here also we see that Jesus displays his glory, verse 11. The Old Testament word that we translate into English as glory has, as kavod, has a connotation of weight or status or importance. The New Testament word, doxa, also perhaps is the idea of importance, etc., but has a connotation of shining or brilliant. The glory of something is that which distinguishes that thing from other things. So when Jesus displays his glory in these miracles, it's showing something about the uniqueness of Jesus. What does Jesus do in this first miracle we're looking at? Well, he turns water into wine, but he does it in a very unspectacular way. He doesn't wave his hands over the water and say, "Now I'll become wine." He doesn't say, "Listen, everybody, pay attention, I'm going to do something spectacular," etc. No, he gives the instructions for these servants, doesn't even tell anybody what he is doing, but when the stuff is carried to the master of ceremonies, it turns out to be wine. As C.S. Lewis pointed out, in turning water into wine, Jesus does something quickly and miraculously that God does every year, slowly and providentially, by means of grapevines. See Lewis's book, Miracles. What does this miracle mean? Well, Jesus' disciples will naturally see this miracle against the background of Old Testament events. They haven't read the New Testament yet. The events largely of the New Testament haven't happened yet, this early in Jesus' career. So what kind of similar miracles do we have in the Old Testament? Well, we don't have any miracle of water turning into wine, or even water turning into something else. However, in Genesis 21, we have Hagar and Ishmael provided with water. I don't know whether it's miraculous or not, but Hagar couldn't find water and was fearful that she and her son were going to die of thirst. And then we have the water miracles in the wilderness wanderings narrated for us in Exodus 15, Exodus 17, and Numbers 20. And then when Samson feels like he is going to collapse from thirst, in Judges 15, he is provided with water, and that seems to be miraculous. The Exodus Numbers ones also do. Some other similar miracles. The water at Jericho is bitter and is sweetened in 2 Kings 2. Judah's army over in Edom, invading Edom, is rescued by water supplied in a striking way, 2 Kings 3, at least a rather striking providence, if not a more miraculous sort of miracle. And then in 2 Kings 4, a stew into which some plants have been put that are at least bitter and maybe even poisonous is repaired by the actions of, that's believed, Elisha in that case. There's also perhaps some other non-miraculous background to this miracle. Wine, of course, was not only something used at weddings, and in fact a very standard drink in the Near East, where that was probably the commonest alcoholic, that and beer were the commonest alcoholic beverages. But wine was used in the drink offerings at the temple. And of course the blood of animal offerings was an important part of the temple ritual as well, and rather common both in the Bible and in other places in the ancient Near East to make some comparison between blood and wine. Those may have some significance in regard to symbolism of what Jesus is doing here. Notice in verse 4, Jesus says, "My hour has not yet come." A number of people have taken this to mean that he wasn't ready to do miracles yet. However, elsewhere in John, this kind of expression in Jesus' mouth refers to his crucifixion. See John 12:23 and John 12:27. So here it probably does not mean my time to do miracles has not yet come, but that the time of my death has not yet come. An interesting hint then as to what may be going on in this particular miracle. John's Gospel gives considerable emphasis to the symbolism of Jesus' words and his actions. In both the Old Testament and the New Testament, the marriage or marriage feast is used as a symbol of the age to come, or of the messianic banquet. We see this in Psalm 1, Psalm 23, Isaiah 25, Isaiah 54, and then in the New Testament in Matthew 8, verses 11 through 12, and Matthew 22, verses 1 through 14. So Jesus will somehow provide the wine or joy for the feast, which otherwise would lack it. Summary, Jesus turns the water into wine to rescue this wedding feast from disaster, to save the hosts from embarrassment, and to show us something of who he is and what he's come to do. He does something that only God does, if you like, but he does it quickly in order that we might see an intervention here. Rather than saying, okay, well, fellas, come out here and we're going to wait a season while these grapevines produce grapes and then we're going to make wine, et cetera. It'd be a little tricky for the wedding feast, as you can guess. So Jesus turns the water into wine to rescue the wedding feast from disaster, to save the host from embarrassment, and to show something of who he is and what he's come to do. Jesus has come to rescue us from embarrassment and disaster at the last judgment. Jesus has come to bring us joy at the Messianic banquet. And the way he's going to do that probably wouldn't catch this from the miracle by itself, turning water into wine. But when you start thinking then, after you've heard about Jesus' whole career and read the rest of the Gospel, you see the connection with the Lord's Supper. And John brings that out explicitly, not in a narration of the Lord's Supper, which he does not give, But a narration of Jesus' explanation of the feeding of 5,000 in John 6. Some lessons for us. Jesus is no show-off, but he really is who he claims to be. The Father's Son, who does everything the Father does. John 5:19 and following. So, we can trust him fully with our lives. If we trust him, he will one day be our chief joy. We should seek to grow in our love for him even now. Let him be the chief joy of your life here and now. We move to the second miracle here in our discussion, the stilling the storm in Mark 4, 35 to 41. Here's what the passage looks like in NIV again. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along, just as he was, in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. His disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Let's look at the story first. Jesus and his disciples are crossing the Sea of Galilee from the northwest side, near Capernaum, to either the northeast side or the southeast side. There's some debate which. It depends on the location. But where they're headed for is where the incident with the demons and the pigs will take place in Mark 5, 1-20, which will in fact be the next miracle we'll discuss. Jesus is apparently worn out from the day's activity, looks tired, and has fallen asleep in the back of the boat. Astonishingly, the waves sloshing over into the boat do not awaken him. A storm comes up which begins to swamp the boat. Apparently the storm is quite fierce, since even commercial fishermen experienced on this lake are terrified. That would characterize several of the disciples who were commercial fishermen, Peter, James, and John, and Andrew. The disciples finally become so distressed that they awaken Jesus and do what they clearly would not do very often, rebuking him that he doesn't care that they're about to die. That seems to me to be some indication of the degree of their terror, their distress. Jesus stops the storm with a word, and suddenly there's a great calm. That's itself a little surprising. If you turned off the wind immediately, the waves would keep sloshing around for perhaps an hour or two till they finally stopped, because the friction involved in waves is not such for them to quit immediately. That there's suddenly great calm indicates that something quite surprising and something quite miraculous has happened here. Then Jesus rebukes the disciples for their fear and lack of faith. Their response, "Who is this that even the wind and sea obey him?" We see two themes going on, I think, in this incident then. The theme of the disciples' lack of faith, and the theme of, what does this tell us, this miracle? Tell us about Jesus, that even the wind and sea obey him. Well, as we seek to investigate its meaning, we look, first of all, and this is, I think, rather important in regard to Jesus' miracles in general, is to look at the Old Testament background, the miracles that have taken place in the Old Testament that resemble this, because that's the background the disciples would have. And so that's the background into which Jesus is speaking or doing these miracles. Well, in Job 1, Satan calls out the storm, the one that knocks the house down on Job's children and kills them. In 1 Kings 18, Elijah calls up a storm to bring an end to the drought that has been going on for 3.5 years. But Jesus, by contrast, stops a storm. And it's interesting how he does that, to compare Jesus' actions with those of the Old Testament prophets. Elijah prays and prays, sends a servant up 7 times to see if anything is happening. So, obviously, Elijah has some serious problem calling up the storm. Moses announces what God is going to do. That's what God is going to do. And then he uses a staff, typically, as the medium for his miracles, if you like. Well, Jesus typically works without media. He does use some clay once in healing a person of blindness. That itself, I think, has some symbolic significance. Although Jesus certainly gives credit to God the Father, etc., God his Father, he will often announce what he is going to do, or just do it. What's the meaning of this miracle? Well, nature has been a threat to humans ever since the fall of mankind. Because of human rebellion against God, God's punishment allows nature to rebel against humans. God's actions in the Old Testament help to illustrate the meaning or illuminate the meaning of this miracle as well. You remember in Genesis 1 that God creates by means of his word. And so here Jesus, with a word, shut up, be quiet, stops the storm. God rescues mariners from a storm in Psalm 107. And this psalm is particularly striking in the way it is parallel to Mark's account of this particular miracle. It looks like it was intended to resonate with Psalm 107, that is, the miracle was. Let's look at it. Psalm 107, 23-31. In the midst of a series of disasters or dangers that happen, we have a picture of God rescuing people, etc. Here's the one we're interested in, verse 23 and following. Others went out on the sea in ships. They were merchants on the mighty waters. seeth all the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens, went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunken men. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to their desired haven. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for men. So the meaning of this miracle, are the disciples protected by Jesus' presence? Obviously, since he is the Messiah, he must survive to carry out his mission. Of course, the boat might sink and Jesus walk away on the water, since we see elsewhere that he is capable of doing something of that sort. But instead, he protects his followers here, as he also does at his arrest. What about this thing about Jesus being asleep in the boat? Is he tired? Well, that certainly wouldn't be surprising, given his previous activity. From the context, it appears that the point is that Jesus is asleep because he is trusting, in contrast to his disciples. His disciples are fearful. Their faith is not what it ought to be. Jesus is not fearful. He can sleep even in the midst of all this. Note this interchange, Mark 4:38 and following. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" See the connection there. Some lessons from this miracle about Jesus. Jesus is human. He gets tired. He falls asleep. But Jesus is not merely human. He's also God. He commands the weather, and it must obey. Jesus, as perfect human, has perfect trust in his Father. Some lessons for our lives. We as followers of Jesus ought to live in trust like he did. We are safe in God's arms. Perhaps this is what Paul has in mind when he says, we are the fragrance of Christ. That when people see our lives, they see something of Christ in us. He's talking about real believers. As some have said, we are immortal, put quotes around that, until we have finished the task God has for us. Even our death need not be meaningless if we will trust him with our lives. Well, that's our tour of the stilling of the storm. We come to the third miracle, the Gerasene demoniac, found in Mark 5:1-20. A few words about demonism. Liberals deny demonism. Some evangelicals tend to downplay it, seeing it as misdiagnosed mental illness. Well, given the cure rate of psychiatrists and psychologists with mental illness, which is about the same as witch doctors with demonism, it may well be that some mental illness is misdiagnosed demonism. Here's our passage, Mark 5:1-20. They went across the lake to the region of Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." Allusion to the term for a group of 6,000 Roman soldiers. And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on a nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission. And evil spirits came out and went into the pigs, The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man, and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell them at Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. Well, let's look at the Old Testament background here. Jesus' disciples would not have had much to go on in this matter. The Old Testament is explicit about the existence of Satan and evil supernatural powers and connects them with idolatry and false religions. The Old Testament also indicates Satan is capable of miraculous activity, as were the magicians of Pharaoh in Exodus. Otherwise, the main Old Testament background for a demon possession would be the evil spirit that comes on Saul and the lying spirit that misleads Ahab's false prophets. However, a New Testament background gives us much more on this. Demonism shows up strongly in the Gospels. Perhaps this is due to demonic flocking to oppose Jesus, or perhaps to pagan influence that has come into Judaism in recent centuries at this point. Some varieties of later Judaism, in any case, have been heavily influenced by the occult. Other background in the New Testament period, we find demon exorcism, that is casting out demons, in Josephus and in the apocryphal book of Tobit. We have a number of magical papyri from this period, showing that the name of Yahweh was viewed as a powerful charm even among the pagans. Recall also the account in Acts 19, where Jewish exorcists tried to use the name of Jesus as a charm, but it rather backfired on them. Typical exorcism of this period involved a great deal of mumbo-jumbo, hocus-pocus, or whatever you want to call it. Tobit, the hero, burns a fish liver in a censer to make a powerful stink to chase the demon away. Josephus narrates an Essene exorcist who uses a ring containing an herb prescribed by Solomon, and with that ring in, with the herb in it, he's able to draw the demon out of the nostril of the fellow who is possessed. The papyri, magical papyri, give us long strings of foreign words and names used as spells to drive out demons. Jesus' actions are much more sober than this, huh? He commands the demons to leave, and they have to do it, though there is some negotiation for reasons not explained. Much of this narration is somewhat obscure, as we cannot tell who is acting in the case of possession. Does the man run to Jesus seeking deliverance? Or are the demons in control of him, and they run to Jesus seeking to harass him before they realize who he is? Do the pigs panic and run into the lake when the demons get into them? Or do the demons drive them there? Or even, does Jesus let the pigs, the demons get into the pigs and then drive the pigs himself into the lake to drown the pigs and put the demons out without any bodies to be able to get into? We don't know. It reminds us again that the unseen world is an unseen world. We don't know what's going on in it. We have some special revelation about it, which we do well to follow. There is lots of anecdotal information from demon possession and from other activities, some of which is occult. And how much of that is giving us accurate information and how much of that is staged even by supernatural beings, we can't tell. We're on this side. We don't know exactly what's going on. We only see what shows up over here. Some lessons from this miracle. This world is a very dangerous place, and not just with danger from humans and nature. We can easily be overwhelmed by evil forces far more powerful than we are. We don't know the exact boundaries of their authority. We don't know exactly how it is that people get demonized. Is it something that they have no control over, or something that they what the demon is. We don't know the exact boundaries there. Again, we've got anecdotal stories. We have every reason to believe that these demons are older, wiser, and more evil than humans are. Some further lessons. Jesus can overcome demons even by the thousands. So it makes sense to flee to Jesus for protection. In fact, Jesus came in the world to destroy the works of Satan, his kingdom, and his power. This incident, like a number of Jesus' miracles, looks both backward and forward. Miracles sometimes look backward to creation, or backward to the history of Israel, and they frequently look forward to the end of the age, the eschaton. This one looks back to the fall and its consequences, where, which we say, oppressed by Satan because of the fall, and it looks forward to Jesus' return and the destruction of evil. Here Jesus cast these demons out of this one man, but there have been many people since then who have been oppressed by demons. We move on to our final two miracles. The woman with the hemorrhage and Jairus' daughter. Mark 5:21-43. Here we have two miracles that are intertwined by the historical circumstances that they kind of happen together, as you see when we look at the text. We have a few of these sorts of things, intertwining of two different incidents in the gospel materials. It in fact fits the way we often remember events. When I was in high school, I played in 10th grade in the marching band for our high school. And on our Thanksgiving Day game in our sophomore year, we won a spectacular football victory that gave us the state championship with a 43-yard field goal in the last few seconds of the game, that the ball hit the crossbar and went over. Okay. And so right after the end of the game, our marching band was out there marching around playing our high school fight song, etc., and I managed to break the reed off my clarinet right at that point. So I was just marching around, pretending to finger it and pretending to blow it, but making no noise. Well, here we have a fairly spectacular thing that happened in my high school career. Our high school won the state championship in football, and a pretty trivial thing, a broken reed, but they interact with each other in such a way that I remember even the trivial thing from the big one. Huh? Well, let's have a look at Mark 5:21-43, where this material is narrated for us. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus, seeing Jesus, fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. "My little daughter is dying," he says. "Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed, pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciple answered, "and yet you can ask, who touched me?" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid. Just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talita kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately, the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat. Well, what kind of similar Old Testament miracles do we have here? Well, we've got some resurrections. We've got Elijah raising the widow's son. We've got Elisha raising the Shunammite woman's son. We've got the fellow thrown in Elisha's grave. Healings. We've got God giving Miriam leprosy and later healing her. And we've got Elisha healing Naaman's leprosy and later giving leprosy to Gehazi. Other Old Testament background, well, uncleanness comes into this passage, I think. Uncleanness is a ritual state which prohibited a person from taking part in a formal worship in tabernacle or temple. Uncleanness could be contracted by having certain diseases, such as leprosy or hemorrhage. It could also be contracted by touching an unclean person or unclean object. Now, we think about Jesus' actions in these two miracles. He feels power flow out from him when touched by the woman in the crowd. Yet he apparently doesn't know who touched him. You always have a problem when the question is asked, whether the person asking the question knows the answer to it or not. And having been a teacher for 35 years, I know that I have now and again asked questions which I know the answer to. But I think we see something here of Jesus' humanity. There's warrant from various things said in the Gospels to suggest that Jesus set aside his omniscience and some of his other powers during his earthly ministry, and that his miraculous powers and his miraculous knowledge were mediated to him through the Holy Spirit, and that's part of the reason for the Holy Spirit coming upon him. And the reason for all of this is that Jesus' earthly ministry from his beginning of his incarnation until probably his ascension was a test. And he was tempted always like we are, so that he sets aside the use of these things, which he could use to bail himself out of lots of things otherwise. I think that's what's going on. So apparently he doesn't know who touched him. He calls on the woman to explain what happened. Since Jesus typically does not call attention to himself and his miracles, this probably has some purpose for the woman's benefit, to perhaps help her with boldness, or perhaps to help her realize how this has taken place and give God the glory, etc. Jesus is not upset by this interruption. Doubtless Jairus is, but Jesus is not, nor in general is Jesus upset by relevant interruptions. Now and again, somebody says something that he feels is off the wall in one way or another. A fellow comes up and wants Jesus function as a judge in getting the guy's brother to divide the inheritance properly, etc., and Jesus turns that down and apparently has some realization that there are some bad motives involved in this request as well. Jesus is not upset by this interruption because he's trusting his Father for all the circumstances of life. And he's acting in a way to make best use of those circumstances for his Father's glory. And that, of course, is a good model for us. Jesus encouraged Jairus when the news of his daughter's death arrives, reminding us that bad things may happen in the course of our experience, but we need to keep our trust in God. Well, Jesus' actions then, when he arrives at the house of Jairus, Jesus puts out the bystanders when he heals the girl. He probably makes the remark about the girl sleeping to throw them off the track so that there'll be some question afterwards whether the girl was raised from the dead or whether she was merely healed. In fact, some commentators think she was not really dead because both in Matthew and Luke, the narrator is somewhat uncommittal, says what the people said, but it appears that in Luke's narration, chapter 8, verse 53, where he uses the word knowing that she was dead, seems to confirm that the girl was in fact dead. Jesus allows himself to be touched by the woman, and he touches the girl, and in both those cases, by Old Testament law, he would become unclean. But in each case, the unclean person is cleansed. The woman no longer has the hemorrhage. The girl is no longer dead. And we see the same kind of thing with the case of a leper in one of Jesus' other miracles, where the leper comes up to him and says, Jesus, Master, if you will, you can cleanse me. You can heal me. And Jesus reaches out and touches the leper, something which probably had never happened to the leper since he'd gotten leprosy. yet when Jesus touches the guy becomes clean. Does Jesus become unclean when he touches these people? Don't know the answer to that. It may be. It may be this is an example of Jesus taking upon himself our, what, diseases, our uncleanness, our sins, etc. I don't know. Interesting to think of that. Well, that's our series. A summary of the series. Each miracle and what problem is involved in that miracle and what solution that miracle provides to the problem. In the wedding at Cana, the problem is a need. Something that's going to be a real embarrassment to the family. It's going to be a real disaster to the wedding. But Jesus solves that by turning the water into wine and bringing joy and abundance to the wedding. Still into the storm. Danger. This is a terrible storm. It's probably one of the worst, maybe the worst, that the disciples have ever been in their careers of being fishermen on the lake. And they realize the danger that they may be drowning. And Jesus intervenes to bring safety. It's also a chance for them to see their need for greater faith. The miracle regarding the Gerasene demoniac. The problem, obviously, is the oppression of this fellow by all these demons. And the solution, Jesus rescues the fellow. The hemorrhaging woman, an illness, disease, not sure exactly what the term they call it. It's a physical malady in any case. And Jesus brings her to health. Jairus' daughter, dead, we think, and brought back to life. Some lessons from this series. Jesus is present with us in our need. He has compassion upon us. He has power to save us. Jesus has come to restore what was lost in the fall, to rescue us from our own and others' wickedness, to give us life, health, safety, abundance, and joy. Well, that's the end of this rather brief series. But it helps us to see something about who Jesus is and what he has come to do. May the Lord use that in our lives.